Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And you're listening to Key to the Case. Welcome back or welcome to our show. Thank you all for tuning in today. The disappearance we'll be discussing in this episode reminds me of the second case we covered, Barbara Bolick. There are definitely some similarities, but there are big differences too. So if you were as puzzled by that case as we were, then I think you'll have a similar experience today. I read part of a book called Unsolved Disappearances in the Great Smoky Mountains by Juanita Baldwin and Esther Grubb for this case. The book covers cases other than Polly's, so I'll probably go back and read the rest of it at some point, but my focus was just on the case at hand, and it was a really good resource. Okay, let's dive in. Thelma Pauline Melton, better known as Polly Melton, was 58 years old at the time of her disappearance in 1981. Polly grew up with four brothers and one sister in Leeds, Alabama, located about 20 minutes away from the bigger city of Birmingham, Alabama. Polly seemed to have a wide array of work experience. At one point, she worked for the store Sears. At another point, she was a teacher in Alaska, and she even worked for the federal government. There's no clear outline or timeline of Polly's career path out there. Polly met and married her first husband, who was in the Army, in Charlotte, North Carolina. The fact that he was in the Army could explain why she was in Alaska at one point working as a teacher, or maybe she just wanted to be in Alaska. We don't know. Some reports state that they divorced and others state he passed away. Whichever scenario it was, it prompted Polly to move back home to Leeds, Alabama, and this would be where she met her second husband. According to the Charlotte Observer, he was diagnosed with stomach cancer not too long after they married, and he passed away, leaving Polly widowed for possibly a second time. After her second husband died, Polly went to Bryson City, North Carolina, where her father owned a trailer park. Bryson City is a gateway to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and Polly was well acquainted with the area. It was here where Polly struck up a relationship with her father's friend and business partner named Bob. Now, Polly was 52 when she and Bob began their relationship, and he was 72. So, 20-year age difference, which at the time may not have impacted the relationship, but as time went on and Bob developed a number of serious health issues, primarily issues with his heart, I suspect it impacted their relationship at least to a certain extent.
Did Polly have any kids with either of the two husbands that she had prior?
No, she never had any children. She was a stepmom, though. So Bob had two sons from a previous relationship, and they appeared to have virtually no relationship with Polly. It was kind of strange. It's not completely clear if there was conflict between Polly and the two sons or if they just weren't interested in having a relationship with her, but their behavior after she disappeared indicated a lack of interest in her altogether, but we'll get into that more. So Polly and Bob married in 1975 and they settled into a home in Jacksonville, Florida. However, they spent summers in the Smoky Mountains in their Airstream trailer. I mentioned that Bob had health issues and he was not doing very well at the time of Polly's disappearance. Polly herself suffered from high blood pressure and nausea, which she took daily medication for both of those. And she was known to smoke two packs of cigarettes a day. So her health was in a better state than Bob's at that time. There were no major concerns going on. Although when you read about this case, there are weird remarks about Polly's weight. It's often stated that she was overweight. And I think she felt that way about herself because of some of the comments she made about dieting and wishing she was lighter. But she was 5'11 and weighed between 170 and 180 pounds, which is pretty normal for a woman of that height. If she were considered overweight, it must have been marginal, but I do think her size is somewhat important to consider in the context of this case.
Yeah, her height and weight didn't really seem like she'd be super overweight. Sounds
no
pretty normal, standard.
I know. to the point where I'm like, why do people keep making remarks about this in the sources for this case? It was super strange to me. But like I said, I think it kind of relates in the context of the case. Polly's friends described her as a friendly woman, but she was fairly private. According to the book, Unsolved Disappearances in the Great Smoky Mountains, quote, she had her friends, but by and large kept her feelings to herself. Most of the time, she had a deliberation of movement and speech. On very rare occasions, she would loosen up and banter a bit, end quote. 4 years before Polly vanished, her mother passed away, and this led Polly to fall into a depression to the point she was prescribed Valium. At that time, she also grew closer with her dad. And I don't think it was that they didn't have a relationship before. It was more so that they leaned on each other through the loss. And I think they saw each other more after the loss. Her father had even recently traveled from Alabama to visit her for a couple of weeks before she disappeared. As I said before, Polly and Bob spent their summers in North Carolina. More specifically, they stayed at an exclusive campground near Deep Creek in Bryson City. There were about 10 families, most of whom were retirees, who stayed at this campground. And if anyone new was interested in staying there, the families had to unanimously agree to allow a new family in. In the summer of 1981, when the story takes place, there were no new families at the campground. And Polly was particularly close with two of the women there, Red and Trula. On the afternoon of Friday, September 25th, 1981, Polly, Red, and Trula set off on a hike on Deep Creek Trail in the Smoky Mountains National Park. The hike is about 4 miles round trip or 6.5 kilometers, and it's considered an easy to moderate hike. Most of the time, it's considered an easy hike from what I could find. This was not a surprising choice for Polly, Red, and Trula because it was conveniently located near their campground, and they'd done the hike many times before. This was a populated area too. There were other hikers out that day, some people on horseback. Campers were nearby setting up. There were about 50 cars in the parking lot, and some people even braved the cold water in Deep Creek. According to the Unsolved Disappearances book, quote, cars are permitted on Deep Creek Trail until the road splits about a quarter of a mile inside the park. The right prong of the road provides access to a large picnic area and campground. The left prong is a continuation of Deep Creek Trail. About 100 yards further, the trail narrows and there's a gate across it to keep out vehicular traffic. From this point on, tree and plant cover are very thick on each side of the trail, end quote. I think these details are important to understand and they help kind of paint a picture of the area. Sometime between 3:30 and 4 p.m., the trio reached the end of the trail, which is better known as the turnaround. The trail is basically a big loop. They stopped momentarily so Polly could smoke a cigarette, and then they continued on and headed back to the trailhead. They had walked a distance of about a half mile when suddenly Polly picked up her pace. In fact, she sped up so significantly, it seemed that she intended to leave her friends behind. Trula and Red laughed, but they both thought that Polly would slow her pace. When she continued to walk in this determined fashion, they looked at each other with confusion. Red yelled out to Polly, quote, I wouldn't want to be in a foot race with you, end quote. Polly looked back with a playful smile and laughed, but she continued on and picked up her pace even more.
Maybe she was just hustling to get back to the campground because she needed to use the restroom. I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that. But then I'd wonder why she wouldn't say anything.
Yeah, I guess you said she was a pretty private person. Maybe, I don't know, maybe she felt embarrassed for saying she had to, she needed to hurry up and get back because she needed to go to the bathroom.
I suppose. And, you know, I will tell you some secondhand sources about this case say that before this happened on the hike, Polly was kind of lagging behind. She wasn't walking as fast as Red and Trula. So they gave her a hard time about that. So that would make more sense with the idea being that she's like, oh, I'll show you. I can walk fast. But then you'd think she would slow down at a certain point. And also, I can't find any primary sources that say that's what happened. And the book I read about this case didn't say that either. So I'm really questioning the validity of that. It could have been misreporting. I mean, I think it's a really strange situation because it wasn't typical of Polly. I mean, you have to remember they'd done this hike many times in the past, and it was unusual for her to suddenly speed up and then suddenly speed up with no explanation. I mean, if this were me and two of my friends, I'd be yelling out, you know, what are you doing? Where are you going? But I suppose if my friend looked back and smiled and laughed, then maybe I would just let them go and assume, kind of like you're saying, they had a reason to get back or they just wanted to get back quickly.
Yeah, maybe they'd be more concerned if they were on an unfamiliar hiking trail. But since they've done this one so many times, maybe, you know, maybe they just didn't care that she was speeding up so much.
Well, at least they would know that she wouldn't get lost, most likely, right? Or they know, okay, she can find her way back and we'll see her back at the campground. And they also mentioned how Polly had an intense fear of snakes. So that was another reason they didn't believe Polly would go veering off the trail. And she always remained cautious when she got near the creek. Polly sounded like a cautious person in general to me, not one to be careless by any means. I can't imagine Red and Trula had any sort of inkling that they would never see Polly again at that moment. They watched as Polly ascended up a hill and then descended down the hill and around a bend out of sight while she maintained her pace. This would be their last sight of Polly. There was a bench on the other side of the hill that they predicted Holly would be sitting on when they got to it. They figured she would tire out and need to sit down to rest, and they would all continue on together. But that was not the case. They were puzzled when they saw the empty bench. As they walked on, they thought back to their conversations with Polly before she created the abrupt separation. Just before she sped up, they had discussed a man who had a trailer near where they stayed. They joked that since he was seen at his wife's trailer, so his own trailer, twice that week, he must have been taking a break from, quote, running around with other women, end quote. It was seemingly an open secret that this man was unfaithful to his wife. I mean, I'm not sure if this guy plays into this case at all. He probably doesn't, but how terrible for his wife if that's what people are saying about you. Just before that conversation, Trula and Red teased Polly that there was a, quote unquote, handsome man who had been eyeing Polly at the Bryson City Presbyterian Church Nutrition Center, where she was an ardent volunteer. Polly didn't deny their claims, but she didn't say much at all about it, which they interpreted as her not wanting to say something wrong. So as they were thinking back on these conversations, I think they were racking their brains to know if they said something that might have upset Polly or caused her to want to get away. I know I would definitely be doing that in that situation, because even if I didn't think I said anything wrong, I'd be thinking back to see if maybe something I said could be misconstrued in a negative way. And we have to keep in mind, again, Polly's more of a private person. So maybe the comments about this guy who had been eyeing her just made her uncomfortable. I'm not sure.
So is she having an affair?
I don't think so, no. But some people, I will tell you, some people have suspected that she was having an affair. But as far as I know, we don't have concrete evidence of that. We will discuss that more, though, later on. Trula and Red thought that if they didn't come upon Polly on the path, then surely she must be back at her trailer once they completed the hike. So once they wrapped up their hike and saw that Polly was nowhere in sight, they went to Polly and Bob's trailer. They were taken aback when they learned that Bob was alone in the trailer. They informed him about what happened, and Red enlisted her husband and a friend of Polly's to help her, Bob, and Trula search the area. They checked their private campground as well as the Deep Creek campground and picnic area, but there was no sign of Polly. They asked everyone they came upon if they saw Polly, but no one recalled seeing her or seeing anything odd at all. Then they went back to Deep Creek Trail to the exact spot where they last saw Polly, and they saw no signs that someone had left the trail and walked into the brush. About 2 hours after Trula and Red last saw Polly, Polly's friend filed a missing persons report with Park Ranger Dennis Burnett. Park Ranger Burnett did a simple search on his own. However, he quickly came to the same conclusion as the others that Polly was gone.
2 hours seems pretty quick to file a missing persons report. I mean, I would think they would wait a little longer to see if she comes back on her own, but maybe her strange behavior of speeding up her pace just kind of weirded them out or made them worried, more worried than they would have been if she didn't just suddenly increase her pace by so much.
Yeah, I mean, 2 hours might seem a little soon, but I think you're right. It's the circumstances of her disappearance. I wonder if initially they were kind of worried about some sort of medical event occurring or Polly's out there in the brush needing help or something. So I think the concern was justified in the beginning. That evening, Ranger Burnett brought together other park rangers as well as volunteers from the community to search for Polly, and they closed off Deep Creek Trail to ensure they could search the trail without disruption. One specific focus was a smaller trail that veers off from the main trail near where Polly disappeared, which makes sense to me because if Polly got on this side trail, that could explain why she got out of view quicker than what you would expect. This trail would have led her back to the trailhead. We will be posting a map of this trail on our Instagram, Key to the Case podcast. Personally, I found the visual to be really helpful in improving my understanding of this area. And you can see that the creek kind of runs adjacent to the trail itself. As people who were on the trail exited, they were asked about Polly. No one saw her and no one acted suspiciously. There were also no signs that Polly had been harmed. They didn't find any blood, ripped clothing, or any of Polly's belongings on the ground. Fortunately, there wasn't a great concern of hypothermia because of the time of the year. The temperatures wouldn't have dropped so low that there'd be a risk, and it was pretty dry that day and rain was not expected. But of course, the most ideal situation would be to bring Polly home that night. And I think they may have even expected that they'd be able to do that. Later that night, Polly's father and two of her brothers arrived to help with the search, and later on, her other siblings would join as well. According to the Charlotte Observer, special search dogs were flown in from Virginia, and they began their search about 9 hours after Polly was last seen. A bloodhound named Missy was brought in on Saturday while a grid search of the area was going on. Ranger Burnett indicated that it was difficult for the dogs to work with large groups of people around because all of the varying scents could throw the dogs off, so they scaled back the search at one point to allow the dogs to do their jobs with more ease. Reportedly, the dry weather conditions made it difficult to track a scent, and Missy was the only dog who alerted at all. There was a downed or fallen tree beside Deep Creek Trail that Missy returned to repeatedly. So Missy's handler said that indicated Polly had been at that spot. But unfortunately, and somewhat strangely, Missy couldn't pick up Polly's scent beyond that point. People were known to sit on this fallen tree to rest, so it seems conceivable that Polly may have sat there momentarily.
Where was the tree located? I mean, was it right next to the trail, or did you have to kind of go into the brush to find this tree? Or
yeah, it was more next to the trail. I don't think you'd have to go very far into the brush to sit on it. But I don't know the exact location of it where Missy got the hit, which is unfortunate because in my head, I had been kind of theorizing that maybe Polly went off on that side trail and that's why she was out of view. But if this spot is along the main trail after that point of entry to the side trail, then that's probably unlikely. But we don't know the exact coordinates of where it was.
Yeah, it makes sense if Missy picked up her scent because she was hustling pretty good. So I'm sure she had to take a break at some point.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is how it works, but maybe it's easier for a dog to pick up a scent where someone actually sat down than just her quickly walking, right? And like I said, the conditions being so dry, I guess, hindered the dog's ability. Despite a seemingly thorough search of the area, there was no trace of Polly. So it seemed that if Holly were still in the park at all, she had gotten a great distance away. Deep Creek Trail opened back up to the public on September 29th, 4 days after Polly disappeared, and after a week, the search concluded on October 2nd. Bob did not take the news of Polly's vanishing well. I mean, how could anyone take this kind of news well? He suffered a stroke that night and had to be taken to a local hospital. And he did have a slow recovery. He was admitted to a nursing home back in Jacksonville, Florida, after he was discharged from the hospital. And it was a deeply difficult time for him. And I can imagine that it was frustrating to not be able to help, really, with trying to find Polly. The Charlotte Observer reported that Bob communicated very little after that point, but he has said that there was no strife in their marriage that would have caused Polly to willingly disappear and leave him. Naturally, Bob sold his trailer and never again visited the campground he once loved. The unsolved disappearances in the Great Smoky Mountains book indicated that when one of Bob's sons was informed of Polly's disappearance, he said his only interest was the impact on his father.
Wow.
I know.
Pretty apparent that they did not have a good relationship, or maybe even any relationship.
Right. Yeah. And the two sons have kind of avoided discussing the case with the media publicly. So this explains why I said in the beginning that it seemed that there wasn't much of a relationship between Polly and Bob's sons.
I'm assuming you never found a reason why her two stepsons didn't have a good relationship with her.
I think I might know why they didn't. And I was going to mention this later, but the Missing podcast did an interview with a researcher in this case, and this researcher apparently interviewed one of Bob's sons, who explained that he believed Polly was having an affair and that Bob knew something was going on. I think that would be why he wouldn't be interested in her disappearance, because to him, he probably thought she ran off with this person. If this was his assumption, then he's probably thinking she ran off with the person she's having an affair with.
Why did he think that?
No idea. I couldn't tell you where that came from. It makes me think it was based on conversations with their dad, because if they're saying that they thought he knew something was going on, and if they don't talk to Polly, then I feel like it had to be from their dad, right? It's not like they had much interaction with her where she would have, you know, behaved a certain way that would make them think that. So when no trace of Polly was uncovered, the investigation turned to looking at her life and scrutinizing her behavior and actions on the day she went missing. Outside of walking away at a rapid speed, Polly's friends indicated that her behavior seemed typical and she didn't say anything unusual. Bob, who saw her before the hike, concurred. There were no warnings that Polly was going through anything or had any plans to leave from their perspectives. Items like her ID, money, and medication were back at her trailer. Polly also didn't drive or have her own car, so if she did leave, she would have most likely needed help from someone.
Maybe it was with the, or maybe she got help from the man that she was in an alleged affair with.
Well, we don't know.
I know we don't know, but it's a possibility if she didn't have her own car.
Yes, I do think it's a reasonable theory, but the problem is we just don't know if that's true, and I don't want to assume that, but we will get, again, a little more information about that kind of theory going forward. Investigators learned that Polly usually volunteered at the nutrition center on Friday, but for some reason, unknown to anyone, Polly declined to volunteer that day, and she didn't let the employees and other volunteers know that she wouldn't be there. Of course, since she was a volunteer, she wasn't required to adhere to a set schedule, but the others noted that she usually would give a heads up if she wasn't going to volunteer on one of her usual days. It's not 100% clear how Polly spent the day, but we do know that before she left for the hike, she took a nap and she even prepared the sauce for a spaghetti dish she planned to cook that evening when she returned.
Yeah, the sauce is weird because that's not something you would do if you're planning on leaving your life voluntarily. But I mean, then again, maybe she's trying to convey some semblance of normalcy or making things look like they're normal and then, you know, choosing to abruptly leave.
Yeah, I think it pretty much had to be one of those two options. Like, either she made the sauce because she intended to come home and whatever happened to Polly was not her leaving on her own. Or, like you said, it could have been really well thought out and she made the sauce because everyone's going to have the same thought of who would prepare this spaghetti sauce and then leave their life in the same day. What's the point? 11 days after Polly disappeared, the supervisor of the nutrition center returned from being out of town, and she provided an interesting piece of information that made investigators raise an eyebrow. The supervisor explained that Polly volunteered the day prior to her disappearance, and while she was at the center, she requested to use the telephone to make calls several times, which was something she apparently had never done over the years while volunteering. Now, I don't see how anyone could be 100% certain that she'd never asked to use the phone before, but I think it is fair to say that based on the supervisor's statement, this was unusual behavior for Polly. Sadly, the supervisor didn't overhear any of the conversations and investigators couldn't track the phone number she called, but they did note that there were no long distance charges. Additionally, none of Polly's family members or friends remembered her calling them that day.
Yeah, that's strange. My mind kind of immediately jumps to those calls were preparation calls for when she leaves after the hike, you know?
Yeah, you're really leaning into this theory here, but I kind of do too. Like, it's hard not to think, well, you know, who's she calling while she's volunteering? Who does she need to talk to? It's kind of like going to work. You don't really call people during your work day unless you need to. And I don't want to brush off the fact that her family and friends said, yeah, we didn't remember Polly calling us. So who was she calling?
Yeah, and she's not going to, if those were the calls, she's not going to make them at home, obviously.
Right, right. And multiple calls? I mean, it must have been pretty important, whoever she's talking to. I mean, anytime we're talking about a missing person and the day before they go missing, they do something totally out of character, you have to wonder if the two events are connected somehow. But, and I also don't want to overanalyze, right? Because the reality is any one of us could do something random. And if the next day we disappeared, it would of course look strange when in reality, maybe the two events had nothing to do with each other. So yeah, we just wonder who was she talking to and why didn't that person come forward? In general, the patrons of the center she volunteered at remembered her as a friendly and helpful woman, and they were all just as baffled by Polly's disappearance as everyone else. More interesting information came to light when the pastor at Victory Baptist Church came forward to share information about his encounters with Polly. She was not a member of the church, I assume, because she didn't live there full time, but she was known to attend church services there. And the pastor had known Polly for many years. The pastor recalled one specific conversation he had with Polly a few years prior and after the death of her mother. Polly was in the midst of grieving when she spoke with him, and his way of comforting her was by saying that she would meet her mother again in heaven one day. Polly said she hoped to go to heaven, but then the subject transitioned to people she knew who were cheating on their spouse, and Polly explained that she could never do that to Bob.
Yeah, that's a weird transition. I mean, maybe I'm curious what the other parts of the conversation were in between that, because it doesn't seem like it jumped from that topic to the other one.
I know, right? I thought so too. Like, how do you get from talking about the grief you're feeling from the loss of your mother to suddenly you know people who are cheating on their spouse? There had to be more in between.
Yeah. I mean, didn't you just say that she was worried about not getting into heaven? Maybe there was some guilt on her mind?
I don't know. I mean, that's how we'll find out the pastor took the conversation, but I think it's kind of subjective, and without knowing the full conversation, I guess we can't really say, but he said at the time of the conversation, he didn't really think too much of it. But in hindsight, he believed that she committed adultery, felt guilty about it, and that was kind of her attempt at a confession. So it could be true. It could not be true. This is just his interpretation of that conversation. I don't think it's wildly far-fetched because I don't think most people would bring up affairs other people were having with their pastor unless it was someone maybe really close to them and they felt troubled by the situation. But again, we'll likely never know if she had an affair. So let's get into the theories that could explain what happened here. This is not the end of new information in this case, but the details I have held back, I've done so because I think they fit in best with the discussion of theories. Starting with foul play. So Polly's family, especially her sister Kit, were vocal about their belief that Polly was a victim of foul play. The idea with this theory is that Polly sped up and walked away from her friends for some unknown reason. It could have been what you mentioned. And she met with someone with ill intentions, either on the trail or after the trail. I have a few problems with this theory, but the family explained that someone could have targeted Polly because she wore expensive jewelry. Polly's stepmother told the Charlotte Observer this about the matter in November 1981. Polly was wearing, quote, 3 diamond rings. Somebody could have grabbed her for those rings. She had on her wedding band with, I guess, 8 diamonds on it and her engagement ring that was a diamond cluster and then another diamond cluster Bob gave her for Christmas on her right hand.
So what, did they just take her body?
I know.
Because obviously there wasn't a body anywhere.
I guess that's what they mean. Like they kidnapped her to rob her. They also suspected that she may have had an expensive watch on that day. And Polly's brother-in-law told Ranger Burnett that there was a drug drop called Poke Patch relatively close to Deep Creek Trail where allegedly people who use drugs hung around and drugs were sold as well. He feared that maybe one of these individuals or multiple people kidnapped Polly to rob her, like I said. This patch was 4 miles away, so I mean, not that close when it comes to this case, not to the point where you're just going to run into one of these people. Now, I don't think the theory that someone would want to rob Polly is out of the realm of possibilities, but we have to make a lot of assumptions if this were the case or if foul play were involved at all. And a lot of things would have to work in the perpetrator's favor. First, we have to assume that Polly quickly walking off from her friends was just a random thing she did, and it was a coincidence. Second, we have to assume that someone was able to overpower Polly, who's almost 6 feet tall and between 170 and 180 pounds. And this is where I think her physical description really comes in. Third, we have to assume they were able to overtake her in a way that drew no attention from all the people who are around in the area. Remember, this was a pretty popular spot. Fourth, we have to assume this was somewhat of an isolated event. There were no other reports of other people going missing from this area or being robbed in the period before or after Polly went missing. I don't know about you, but I just find that to be a few too many hoops you have to jump through, a few too many assumptions you have to make for the theory to be really plausible. Although I don't think it can be ruled out.
Yeah, a lot of things have to break a certain way for that one to actually happen. You know, no one heard any screams or anything. If someone was trying to kidnap her, I'm sure she wouldn't have gone quietly.
Right. And it's like, where is this happening? On the trail? Yeah. And then they somehow drag her back or like force her back to where they can get in a vehicle with her or they go into the brush with her and I don't know. It's just really hard for me to follow.
Yeah. And I mean, the first thing you pointed out was that she sped up for no reason. It'd be a massive coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Just right after she speeds up, walks off from them, she just so happens to be robbed and kidnapped that day. I mean, she would be alone. Obviously, someone's probably not going to target her if she's with her two friends. But I mean, what a coincidence. Now, if foul play did occur, I believe Polly was taken out of the immediate area pretty quickly. I don't think they harmed her at the park. And I think it would have had to have happened towards the end of the trail. Another branch of this theory could be that Polly intentionally met up with someone that day and that person harmed her. The second theory involves Polly's disappearance being the result of an accident or some sort of medical episode. And this seems to be what Trula believed to be the most likely option. I think it's interesting to hear what the two people she was with that day believed to be most likely. We can also lump in an animal attack in this category. Trula suggested that maybe Polly had a small and disorienting stroke that caused her to be confused and to begin trudging through the woods until she eventually dropped. From there, she could have succumbed to the elements, or if it were medically related, then that could have been the problem.
Yeah, but the dogs, I'm sure the bloodhound would have been able to find her.
I know. I would think the dogs could track to where she was if she's still there. But the people too. I mean, they did a pretty big search. So I don't know. I mean, I suppose like we talked about in the Barbara Bullitt case, Polly could have stepped off to go to the bathroom and got lost from there. I mean, I don't think there's much of a case though to be made that Polly got lost considering she had done the hike many times before and she was familiar with the area. And her friend said she wasn't all that outdoorsy or into nature, honestly, so she likely wouldn't have chosen to start trekking through the woods of her own volition. If she did get lost, I think it would have to be a result of a medical episode or of some sort. The biggest issue with this is truly that Polly was never found, like you said, and I mean, she must have gotten a great distance away to not be found if that's what occurred.
Yeah, maybe she had a medical episode or something and somehow ended up in the creek. Was the creek, I guess, powerful enough to wash her away, for lack of a better word?
Gosh, well, I think it could be. I know people used it for tubing when the water was high. So don't you think, I mean, if people are using it for tubing. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. But I did read that in March 1982, they brought in a helicopter to fly over the drainage area, I guess before the foliage had been way too thick in the fall to be able to see much. And they didn't find anything. So I don't think that rules out the creek theory, but it makes it less likely in my mind. And the rangers didn't believe an animal was responsible for her disappearance. They explained that in their experience, there was no animal large enough to, in that area, to drag away a woman of her size in such a quick and clean manner that no trace of Polly was left behind. There were no drag marks, no blood, no ripped clothing, nothing. So they really didn't think this was a case of an animal attack. Now, the third theory is that Polly died by suicide. And I would say this is the least popular theory with this case, but I do want to address it. There were no reports that Polly was suicidal or depressed before she disappeared. Going back to the pastor who knew Polly, he told the park rangers that he had seen Polly depressed before when her mother passed. And according to him, she was taking Valium every day back then. He shared that Polly seemed a little bit depressed and a little less active and tidy than usual before she disappeared. But when he compared her behavior to that darker time in her life, it was nothing like that. And he didn't believe she was suicidal. So we never attempt to make mental health assessments on this podcast. We don't have enough knowledge about the victims to do so. And we don't have the background to do so anyway, but I think it's important to note the point of view from someone who had frequent contact with Polly so that we can make an educated guess about her state of mind at that time. The pastor also mentioned that a contact of Bob's told him that a bottle of Valium that was prescribed to Bob was missing from the trailer after Polly disappeared. I want to be completely clear here that this is third-hand information, apparently not even second-hand, so it's hard to determine the veracity of it. If it's true, it could lead us to believe that Polly could have been depressed again. Now, I did look into a possible Valium overdose. And the general information I found about Valium and other benzodiazepines is that it is difficult to overdose off the drug itself. However, the chance of an overdose increases significantly when combined with another sedative such as alcohol. So take that for what it is, but I don't want to go too much further with this theory since we don't even know for a fact that the Valium was missing and Polly took it. Beyond that, though, I'm not sure where Polly would have gone to die by suicide, and you run into the same issue as you do with the accidental theory. She was never found despite extensive searches. I think if this is what happened, then she most likely left the park or at least got pretty deep into the park.
Yeah, I don't really buy into that theory, just pretty much based on the fact that her body wasn't found anywhere in, you know, anywhere in that general area.
How far would she have had to go to not be found? Not like she was one to run marathons or walk marathons or anything crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that she had a phobia of snakes. Like, I don't see her walking out into the brush and during the summertime when, you know, the snakes are probably more out and about. Not really buying into that one.
Yeah, like why would you want to risk running into one of these snakes? The final theory is that Polly left her life willingly. And this seems to be what the investigators think, and I think you think, is the most likely scenario. Although they haven't ruled anything out, they don't believe she's still in the park. But her family has vehemently denied the theory that Polly left her life. The idea would be that Polly set out that day to start a new life and someone helped her. She could have coordinated with someone to pick her up at the trailhead, but she wouldn't want Red and Trula to see that. So she sped ahead of them to escape without being seen.
This theory so far seems the most likely to me. Yeah, I just keep going back to they couldn't find her. So it seems like she definitely left the area.
Yeah, and I suppose there is a small possibility that maybe she is still there and just hasn't been found, but yeah. I think it's less likely. I mean, it does seem like a strange time to pick to leave your life during this hike, and if she did this, she did it basically empty-handed. She didn't even have her medication. But maybe it's not a strange time to leave if she wanted to create the illusion that maybe there was an accident or someone harmed her. And I suppose it wouldn't be strange to start her dinner like we talked about if she thought ahead and wanted it to look like she went about her normal day's events. Part of what leads me to believe Polly may have left on her own is because she behaved out of the ordinary in a number of ways right before her disappearance. She had never sped off from her friends like that. She made multiple phone calls while she volunteered, which was apparently something she never did. And she declined to volunteer on the Friday she disappeared, which was also unusual. Could it be that these are all coincidences or were they intentional acts? Additionally, no one heard or saw anything to indicate someone harmed Polly. Further, although there had been no activity on her bank account since she disappeared, on April 14th, 1982, about 7 months after Polly vanished, a check made payable to her was cashed at a bank in Birmingham, Alabama. If you recall, Polly was from Leeds, Alabama, which is only about 20 minutes away from Birmingham. This check was for interest she was owed on a bank certificate, and the amount is unknown, but according to investigators, the signature appeared to be Polly's handwriting. But a handwriting expert was never brought in because the expense could not be justified without additional evidence that could help establish Polly's location. When investigators asked the bank teller if they remembered who cashed the check, the teller couldn't remember much of anything about the transaction. I would love to know the dollar amount of this check because what would make it worth it for someone to impersonate Polly? But also, if this were Polly, would she really risk being found for a small amount? I don't know. And this would mean she was back in Alabama where she was from. It's hard to say who would have even gotten a hold of this check, if not Polly. But how would Polly even get it herself, if not from one of her known addresses? I don't know about you, but I found this part of the story to be really interesting. But it also made me think about how it seems significantly easier to start a new life back in 1981 than it would be today.
Yeah, if they saw the name on the check, her real name was, first name was Thelma, right?
Yes.
Thelma Pauline Melton. So it'd have to be, I would think it would have to be a woman who cashed the check.
Yeah, because that is more of a stereotypically female name. Yeah, you would think if the bank teller saw the name and it was a man or something, then they might have thought something was strange, or they might have remembered it more.
Yeah, and it would have to be pretty significant for if it was her to risk that.
I know. And then for there to be no other activity, as far as we know, ever again, seems kind of strange. But I'm like, interest on this bank certificate? I mean, how much could it have been to be worth it? And why would she be back in her, essentially her hometown, where she could run into people who recognized her?
Yeah, if she wanted to start a new life, maybe she wanted to move back home and just couldn't bring herself to tell Bob. And so she thought this was the easiest way to do this.
Yeah, maybe. It's not a very nice thing to do if it's what happened, especially in the state he was in. But
maybe, yeah. I mean, maybe she wanted it to seem like there was an accident on the trail and that he would be able to take that better. I don't
know.
It is still kind of messed up.
I know. And her family really did not think she would do that. And yet, but you also have to think, okay, someone had to help Polly leave, most likely. And it most likely would have been someone in that small community. And there were no reports that anyone from the community was unaccounted for at that time. You'd think maybe someone would notice if somebody else kind of disappeared, at least for some period, too. And if she were having an affair, then you'd think they would have went off together and people would have noticed that person was gone. Also, there were no sightings of Polly over the years that I could find, which works against the theory. And she also left without her medication, but I mean, she could have gotten a new prescription for that. I think it was high blood pressure medication, nausea medication, not something out of the ordinary, really. And that probably could have been off the radar from investigators.
Yeah, I find it kind of funny that Barbara's case, we really focused on Jim having something to do with it, or at least I did, but we're not even talking about Red or Trula.
I know.
Having any involvement.
I think to be fair, we have to consider that they could have been involved, right?
Because they were the last two people to see her.
Like I said in the beginning, it's a really similar situation to Barbara, but I think when it's two people, to me, it just becomes less likely because then those two people have to conspire and make up this story. And also, this trail was definitely more populated than the one Barbara and Jim were on. So it would be harder to pull something like this off. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, but I mean, what would be the reason, though? I mean, it seemed like they were all good friends. Obviously, we don't know the extent of what their relationship was, but it seemed like they were good friends. And there doesn't seem like there'd be a reason for them to harm Polly.
I know. There would be no motive that we know of. I mean, it was the same thing with Jim. There was no motive that we knew of. But I'm glad you pointed that out. Just to be fair, I think we have to consider that it could have happened. And the story is all coming from those two. So everything we're basing this on, the events leading up to her disappearance are all from Red and Trula. But I don't think there's any evidence that they were involved. Polly was declared legally dead 7 years after her disappearance, and her family believed she was dead fairly soon after she went missing. They didn't really seem to have hope that she was still alive. Polly's family expressed frustration with the case and the lack of information and details from the authorities, and sometimes authorities would not respond to their phone calls. They searched the area many times themselves after the formal search was conducted. The family reached out to the Swain County Sheriff's Department and the FBI, and while they both expressed sympathy, they let the family know that they would need the U.S. Park Service to request their help. And because they did not get that, and the lack of evidence of foul play, this seemed to be a hurdle, according to the family. Which, of course, reminds me of last week's case. Polly's family members felt the profound impact of Polly's disappearance and the lack of answers haunted them, and time passing did not alter their feelings. Many of her family members have since passed away without ever receiving those answers. And Polly herself likely has passed away at this point. She would be, how old would she be?
She'd be 100, right? She was, would you say 58 in 1981?
Yes. It's
42 years later. Yeah, she'd be 100.
Yeah, that sounds right. So, I mean, she could still be alive, but I think it's unlikely. Personally, if what happened to Polly was due to an accident or a suicide, I don't think we'll ever have answers. But if something more nefarious happened or she started a new life on her own, then I think we could see resolution. There could be people out there who hold the key to the case, especially if she started anew somewhere else. Maybe the people she interacted with never heard about Polly's disappearance. If you have any information related to Polly's disappearance, you can call the GSMNP at 865-436-1230. Thank you all so much for tuning in to this episode. Always feel free to reach out to us and share your thoughts about this case. That's all for now. We'll be back next week with a new case. Bye.
Bye.